Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. End-of-life planning and drawing up or updating a will are activities that almost everyone knows are the responsible things to do. But often we put them off because contemplating the end of life is often something we don't want to face. However, the COVID-19 pandemic has forced many of us into thinking about our own mortalities. And more people across the country are thinking about advanced directives and wills. Joining us on today's program is Dr. Maria Olander, Associate Medical Director of Hospice of Central Pennsylvania. Dr. Olander, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Scott. Thank you for having me on.
Also, attorney Andrew Rusniak, a member of the law firm of McNeese, Wallace & Newrick, LLC, Estate Planning Practice Group. Mr. Rusniak, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
If you have a question or a comment about advanced directives or wills, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalk, WITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Mr. Rusniak, let me start with you. As I mentioned, the reports from across the country are that more people are updating their wills or drawing up a will, and also their advanced directives, whether it be, a living will or, a power of attorney. And I'm just curious whether you have seen that yourself or with your law firm in particular in this area.
Yeah, that's a great question, and we certainly have. It's been a busy past, 4 to 6 weeks for us, like a lot of other attorneys in the area. Certainly, we've seen an uptick in both new clients, sort of those folks that you mentioned who sort of know that estate planning is kind of one of those things that is the responsible thing to do, but maybe have put it off for one reason or another. And we've certainly seen an uptick in, previous clients who want to revise and update documents. Estate plan documents are something that, even if you've done them once, should be reviewed and updated from time to time. Typically, we recommend sort of in normal times, 3 to 5 years or so to at least pull them out, read them, and certainly make sure that they say what you want them to say, considering the way that life changes so quickly sometimes.
These new clients, are they specifically mentioning COVID-19, coronavirus?
They are, some of them anyway. We have a number of physician clients or folks that work in the healthcare field who this has been, the push maybe that they've needed, as well as, neighbors and friends and family members, things like that. Certainly there's a lot on all of our minds right now, but our own mortality can come to the top of our minds, in a situation like this.
Dr. Olander, I don't know whether you're in a position to talk about seeing an uptick with Hospice of Central Pennsylvania, but I don't know. I'll just ask the question. Do you know whether more people are interested and have approached their advanced directives?
So that is a great question. I've actually taken it upon myself when I see patients to reiterate the importance of completing an advanced directive, particularly for my palliative care patients. They are not on hospice care yet, but they do have a serious or life-threatening medical condition, and we take time to discuss if their condition could be severely affected by, let's say, a COVID-19 positive diagnosis, and if so, do they have their wishes known to their loved ones, to their caring team, that they perhaps do not want to have certain types of medical care done if they are at an end-of-life situation. And I've found that patients are very receptive to these conversations, particularly now, as they fear that their wishes may not be heard, given how, acute this crisis is. They appreciate that they're quite ill and that they need to have a set plan in place.
Maybe we should define some of these terms right up front. Dr. Olander, what is an advanced directive? And when I say "and," that's make it sound like it's singular, and it is not singular. But what are advanced directives?
So in kind of a global picture, an advance directive, it's a written statement that discusses a person's wishes regarding the medical care that they want to have, such as, including a living will, making those wishes known, let's say, to a healthcare proxy, a person who can discuss those wishes with the medical team if you're not able to make them for yourself. They are a way to communicate to your members of your providing team, so your doctors or nurses, about the kind of care that you want should you not be able to communicate yourself.
Mm. And you mentioned living will. Living will, what's
correct.
The difference between a living will and a durable power of attorney for health care?
So a living will is the document that you're completing to specify what your wishes are. A durable power of attorney is the individual, so you're creating the individual who you'd like to have those abilities to make medical decisions for you. So let's say I have a power of attorney for my husband as my power of attorney. He's the one who can make medical decisions on my behalf if I'm not able to make them for myself.
Mm-hmm.
That living will is a document that states what my wishes would be at the end of life or in a end of life situation, and those should be honored. And I encourage patients to talk with their durable power of attorney, whomever they designate, let's say their decision proxy, the patient's decision maker, about what their wishes are specifically in their living will.
So, okay, I think we're breaking it down step by step, level by level, but do not resuscitate order, DNR, as many people refer to them in the healthcare industry. Is a DNR part of a living will or something that a durable power of attorney would have to consider?
It is. A durable power of attorney would have to consider the potential that a person does not want a resuscitation event. So let's say DNR means specifically do not resuscitate. I state as to my patients, it means allow a natural dying process. A durable power of attorney, a person who is designated as your decision maker, if you have not told them your wishes, they would have to understand what your wishes are. Most likely, if those wishes are not written down or if no one knows, a medical team has to proceed with a full code scenario. And we can discuss what that entails. But short of, having those wishes discussed with your, individual proxy and short of having them in your living will, you're going to have the likelihood of having a full code should you be, let's say, without a pulse and not breathing. So that DNR is part of the advanced directive planning.
And we're going to talk more about that in just a moment. Andrew Rusniak, with Living Wills and Durable Powers of Attorney for Healthcare, is an attorney's advice needed for those two scenarios?
That's a good question. The law does not require that durable healthcare power of attorney take any one specific form. That is different and opposite from a financial power of attorney. But with respect to a healthcare power of attorney, the law does provide, at least in Pennsylvania, for a sample form document. My understanding is that it was put together a number of years ago by the Pennsylvania Bar Association and the Pennsylvania Medical Association. And it is fairly comprehensive. It includes both a durable health care power of attorney component. So it's the part of the document that names an agent who can make health care decisions for you. You could not do those things for yourself. It also includes a living will component. And the living will component is sort of the second part of the document that, Dr. Oleander's point, becomes effective if you are in what's known as an end-stage medical condition, which in the law is defined to mean that you're permanently unconscious with no realistic hope of recovery as certified by your attending physician at the time.
Hmm.
So certainly the form is drafted and it's put out there to be filled in. Whether or not it could be completed with I wouldn't say that it requires an attorney, for example. I think that it's written well, although certainly questions come up, and I know that clients often have questions about when the various parts of the form become relevant, and so we certainly do like to, or at least prefer to, walk our clients through that form.
All right, we have a question from Barb, and I think this is a really good question because she brings up a number of questions that have to do with what's different now during this pandemic and social distancing. Barb says, because my husband and I are in the high-risk age group for contracting COVID-19, we quickly updated our wills, powers of attorney, and living wills, and we're fortunate to have them notarized the same day Governor Wolf announced the closure of non-essential businesses in Pennsylvania. Had we waited one more day, we would not have been able to complete this process. We are wondering whether or not estate planning attorneys should be considered essential during this crisis. Could they be permitted to have limited office visitation for notarization with social distancing and conduct prior client meetings via FaceTime or Zoom and use electronic document exchange? Now, Andrew, I don't know whether you want to comment on the part of whether attorneys should be considered non-essential or essential. I'll let you do that if you want to. But the questions that Barb brings up are good ones because there are documents that must be notarized. So I'll ask the broad question, what is different right now during this pandemic and social distancing, businesses being shut down, than before, and how would it be, what are some of those differences?
Yeah, Barb's question is a great one, and it's really highlights the largest issue that we've been facing as estate planning attorneys is to say, how do we get documents from draft form into final execution form and to get them executed? Historically, the process has typically been to meet with clients in person to review and discuss estate planning in general. And then once the documents are in final form, we have sort of a formal signing process where there's a notary and two witnesses. In this sort of age of social distancing and the governor's order does apply to law firms. Every law firm in Pennsylvania right now is the physical locations are closed currently. The hard part for us has been, what's the best way to help clients, especially those, in Barb's situation or even, or heaven forbid, are facing death sooner rather than later. What we've been sort of explaining to clients is that at least with respect to wills, so the document that becomes effective once you pass, Pennsylvania does allow for what are called holographic wills, which means that a will is valid and effective if it's signed and dated at the bottom. A will itself does not specifically require witnesses or a notary. It is recommended in order to smooth the probate process, but it's not specifically or strictly required. That is different from financial powers of attorney and healthcare powers of attorney. So Pennsylvania statute says that with respect to a healthcare power of attorney, it must be signed and dated at the end by the principal, and it needs to be witnessed by two individuals who are over the age of 18. So certainly, in this time where, social distancing, we have a number of clients that are in retirement communities, for example, those communities are locked down. They are not to see their neighbors. What do we do there? The harder question, I think, is the financial power of attorney, which actually does require a notary. Many clients can't get to notaries right now. So I do know that the Department of State is sort of working on some emergency provisions that may allow for video conference notarying. There was just last week, actually, some potentially helpful guidance that came out, at least with respect to electronic signatures and electronic notaries. To be quite honest, though, we're not quite there yet. The guidance that we got last week doesn't really get us across the hurdle of how do we get a notary to witness and notarize estate plan documents that require it. So
that's kind of a big deal.
It's a very big deal, and the electronic notaries have there's an electronic notarization act has typically and always been used in sort of the business context. It's been used for contracts and for government. It hasn't ever really previously been used for personal documents, and sort of the underpinning, the reason why we've allowed electronic notarization in the business context is that you have sort of multiple parties keeping sets of eyes on documents, and so we were generally comfortable with electronic notarization because we have multiple people looking at it. It's never really been applied to estate plan documents because they're singular, and there's never really been sort of a test of electronic notarization for estate plan documents. I know some estate planning attorneys take the position that an electronic notary is not sufficient for estate plan documents, but the statute was never intended to be used for that. And if you read it sort of word for word, it doesn't actually apply to estate plan documents.
Well,
so,
at this time. It would seem that that would be something that, whether it's the Department of State or just what government entity, must deal with and address.
Well, that's right. You know, like you say, you know, for wills and for trust agreements, we can have those, you know, executed, and they are valid. The healthcare power of attorney, you know, what we're recommending is, you know, if you can find someone to, you know, practice social distancing and be a responsible distance away, if you can have two witnesses and pass that document back and forth, you know, that would be sufficient for the healthcare power of attorney. But the financial power of attorney does require a notary, though, and the statute is quite clear on that.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. For more information on advanced directives and wills, plus a deeper look into the changing tide of healthcare, check out WITF's Transforming Health online at transforminghealth.org, a partnership of WITF, WellSpan Health, and Capital Blue Cross. We're talking about advanced directives and wills, end-of-life care, and, you know, there's a lot to talk about during this pandemic, COVID-19 pandemic. Many people, as you heard from our guest, are more interested in updating or maybe even drawing up for the first time their wills or advance directives. Our guest today, attorney Andrew Rusniak, a member of the law firm of McNeese, Wallace & Nurick, LLC. He's in the estate planning practice group. Dr. Maria Olander is associate medical director with Hospice of Central Pennsylvania. If you have a question or a comment, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Advanced directives, this is Cheryl who is commenting. Advanced directives usually cover different interventions that may be used when a person is seriously ill. Please discuss the likelihood of recovery when one has a cardiac arrest with a code, the usefulness of feeding tubes and advanced illness, etc. Many people are under the assumption that it happens like on TV. Everyone is whole in the end, not so. So, Dr. Olander, what about that?
I think that's a great comment. So, you know, in actuality, the event that a person will recover from a full code situation, meaning that they get CPR, they have intubation, mechanical ventilation, you know, it actually could be very different depending upon their prior state of health. For some people who have chronic medical conditions and they are chronically ill, their recovery to a point where they will be at a functional status where they were prior to the event may be very, very low. And that is exactly not what you see on television. It's not like an ER show where you get, you know, two chest compressions and the person magically comes back to life. It is actually quite an invasive and oftentimes very painful and uncomfortable process. And oftentimes the recovery that a person could undergo is equally as uncomfortable and painful, and they may not regain the functional abilities that they had prior to that event.
You know, one of the things I'm curious about is we've heard so much during this pandemic about ventilators. And you mentioned intubation. Is a ventilator considered a heroic measure, for example?
It is. So, you know, there are times where a person has a severe cardiac arrest and their heart is not functioning, and thus they, you know, they're not able to oxygenate their body. They're not able to get, you know, blood to where it needs to go. And on top of that, they could have, you know, issues with obviously oxygenating from the lungs. So they're not able to theoretically, you know, survive on their own. They're not able to breathe on their own. So they need to have a machine that breathes for them. A ventilator is a machine that allows a patient to be, you know, have oxygen exchange by mechanical means. And what we're seeing in the COVID-19 crisis is the unfortunate situation that a lot of patients are becoming very acutely ill, requiring ventilator support as they're not able to breathe for themselves, and their recovery from this is unfortunately extremely low. And so we're seeing patients become intubated, so ventilated, and then they're not getting off these ventilators successfully. They are dying from a very severe case of COVID-19.
So, you know, going back to then the living will, or for the durable power of attorney for health care, once a patient is on a ventilator for COVID-19, I mean, there is a chance for recovery.
Correct.
But, I mean, that would seem to be a difficult decision for someone.
Correct. So for someone who had perhaps a very good functional status, meaning that they did not have a very severe chronic medical condition prior to them becoming ill, they were robust and healthy prior to their illness, you know, they may have a better chance of recovering. And so what an important conversation to have with their loved one, specifically the person they designate as their healthcare agent, would be, you know, if it looks like the doctors are telling me that they're going to think I'm going to recover and it looks like I have to be on a vent temporarily, then I think I'm okay being vented temporarily. I think I'm okay being on a ventilator. But if I have a chronic medical condition, like an underlying severe COPD, and I am extremely ill or I'm immunocompromised and I get sick, very sick, and it does not look like I'm recovering on the ventilator, that might be, you know, an excellent question to have, you know, prior to this event with your loved one to say, if it does not look like I am improving on the ventilator, then it might be that time to say, let's focus on comfort and quality of life instead of further aggressive disease-directed therapies.
What about the doctor's role in this? And I'll ask it two ways. Under normal circumstances, what does the healthcare provider, what is the role that they play in this? And during COVID-19, with just a scenario you described, I can see the doctor's advice obviously being huge in this decision-making process.
Absolutely. So at a baseline, you know, physicians should be asking loved ones of patients about wishes that they had, you know, discussed prior to these aggressive events, if possible. They should inquire if a patient has created a living will. Do they have advance directives in place? Do they know who a, you know, healthcare agent is that can make those decisions for that patient if they're not able to make them for themselves? The COVID-19 crisis is becoming very difficult to manage, certainly in the realm of a ICU, as patients are coming in who, you know, even patients that were actually robust and quite healthy before, and they're coming in extremely ill. And that's becoming very difficult for intensive care physicians to, you know, assess, are these patients going to be surviving? Are they at risk of decompensating quite quickly? And, you know, if they didn't have advanced directives before, they didn't think they needed them, they didn't think that it was important because they were so well prior to that, it becomes a real challenge to talk to their loved ones because that wish that, you know, if you're not recovering, it may not have ever been discussed. It may not have ever been addressed with their loved ones. If I become so critically ill, what do you want the doctors to do? So it's making doctors face a lot of difficult discussions and decisions with their patients' family members that could have otherwise been, you know, a much, let's say, a much different situation if those loved ones knew what that patient's wishes were prior to them becoming ill.
Let's take some phone calls. Barbara is in Quarryville. Barbara, you're on the air.
My question is, I have a living will. I have advanced directives. I'm in touch with my POAs. I also wear a DNR bracelet. Am I going to be safe? I don't want to be kept alive by any medical means.
Are you asking whether that bracelet is enough to provide information to the doctors?
Well, yeah. If you end up in the hospital unexpectedly, is that enough?
Mm-hmm. All right.
I mean, I have all the rest of the stuff in place.
All right, Barbara, thank you very much for your call. What about that?
I think that's a great question, Barbara. So what I would encourage you to do is make sure that you have that advanced directive in a place that you know and a place that your healthcare agent knows. Also providing a copy to your physician's office and making sure they have it in their electronic medical record so that it's accessible to any provider that cares for you. Hopefully that provider will be able to share it with any inpatient treating teams. Additionally, if you have a chronic medical condition and if you're, you know, concerned about the possibility that you might have to face, let's say, EMS coming to your door if you become acutely ill and you don't want to have CPR, it might be fruitful to talk with your physicians about something called a Pennsylvania Order for Life-Sustaining Treatment. It's a colloquially known as a POST form, and those are orders from a medical provider that indicate your wishes regarding acute care. They are typically, I tell patients, hang them on the fridge so that EMS knows where to find them. And those forms, it's a bright pink form, encompasses several questions. Specifically, do you want cardiopulmonary resuscitation? And that's if you have no pulse and you're not breathing. But if you do have a pulse and you're breathing, do you want comfort measures only? Are you comfortable with, you know, passing peacefully in the home with comfort measures in place, or do you want to have full treatment, including intubation, mechanical ventilation, et cetera? It also discusses elements like antibiotics or artificial hydration and nutrition. These forms are orders from a physician, and they might be useful to you, you know, if you have chronic medical conditions and perhaps a limited life prognosis. I recommend them strongly to my palliative patients as a way to communicate with EMS providers about their wishes in case they're not able to communicate with them directly.
Let's go to the phone. Nicole is in Hershey. Nicole, you're on the air.
I just wanted to thank you guys so much, specifically Dr. Oleander, to speaking to this. My husband and I are both in healthcare, and it is so hard to have these conversations, sometimes over the phone, especially with COVID, with family members who are very sick very suddenly. So I just can't express my gratitude enough for you so eloquently describing what end of life looks like and sharing it with the public, because it's not what it looks like on TV. So
I think we really
thank you guys.
Nicole, thank you very much for your call. But I think that one of the things that is coming out of this is that TV is not a good example of how this actually works. We have an email along those same lines. Joe says, I'd like to know how to get through to my wife on the subject of wills, etc. I've had a will, POA, medical POA, for almost 20 years since I was in my late 40s. However, my wife refuses to discuss it or go to an attorney to discuss it. She says that she has beneficiaries named on her financial accounts and life insurance, so that is enough. I have suspicion that she doesn't want to think about end of life, and she also doesn't want to spend the money on the attorney. Do your guests have any suggestions on how I can get through to her without the usual argument? Andrew Rosniak, let me start with you on that one.
Yeah, no, it's her concern is not unique to her. Unfortunately, there are plenty of folks, and I've worked with plenty of clients that said that same thing. Usually my response is something along the lines of, you know, you don't do estate planning for yourself. You do it for your loved ones, because really they're the ones that are going to be sort of left to clean things up and to settle the formal process, you know, if something were to happen to you. You know, you do it for them to sort of ease their burden as much as you can. It's not an easy process, certainly. It's certainly not easy to think about, but it is an important one. And like I say, you do it especially for the ones you care about. The interesting part is, you know, beneficiary designated assets, we call them non-probate assets, meaning assets that pass not through the will or through the probate process. There are only sort of certain types of assets that pass that way. The main ones are life insurance and retirement accounts, or anything that has a TOD or POD designation on it, a transfer on death or payable on death. Any other assets, any asset that is in your individual name will not pass by beneficiary designation. So bank accounts, real estate, vehicles, things like that. Those assets will only pass either through your will, if you have one, or if you don't have a will, through the Pennsylvania intestate process. And Pennsylvania has a statute that says, you know, how your estate is to be disposed of if you pass without a will. Oftentimes, clients are surprised to find out that it's not always what you think it is. It's not just my spouse gets everything. What Pennsylvania law says generally is that if you have a spouse and children, the spouse gets the first $30,000 of your estate plus one half of the balance, and the remaining 50% goes to your children. Most spouses, by and large, see their wealth as sort of a marital unit and typically don't want to benefit children until both spouses have passed. Well, that's not actually what the statute says if you don't have a will. So a will is to override the statute and to implement your wishes. You know, depending on, you know, life circumstances, old wills could have been made sort of either invalid, or there could have been changes made to them without even knowing about it. So, for example, if you get divorced or if you get married, those are events that the law will apply a different set of facts to, and your will be interpreted differently depending on whether or not that happened to you. If you had another child, that may or may not be taken into account depending on what your will says. So going back to my point earlier, it is good, you know, to review your documents, you know, every 3 to 5 years, and if nothing else, just to have sort of the peace of mind and knowing that your documents are still in good order, because life does change so much and so quickly.
Dr. Olander, let's talk about advance directives. That the same question that the listener had, can't getting a spouse to address this issue. As we established right up front in our conversation, there are more people who are thinking about it. Maybe this gives them the opportunity to think more about it. But what about those people? I think we all know them that don't want to deal with these issues because, I don't know, for whatever reason, they think it may come true if they do.
This is a very salient point in this day and age. And the things that I tell my patients when they say, you know what, I don't need it right now, I don't want to talk about it, I say, okay, is there someone that you would feel comfortable talking about it with? And I will oftentimes have, when I do a palliative consultation, the husband will look at the wife and say, well, my best friend from fifth grade, who I still am friends with now, is going to be my power attorney. And the wife looks at me and says, what? Really? Okay. All right. And you know, it's funny, but we say anyone that you trust most specifically to have those discussions with, have them. Please, we implore you as the medical team, it doesn't have to be a spouse that you designate as your healthcare agent. And that can be hard for some, you know, couples because they are so, you know, tied together. But these decisions are so important that if your spouse wants to talk with a best friend or a cousin, they think, you know, perhaps my wife or spouse or husband is too emotionally attached, and I fear that they won't be able to make these decisions if I am not able to make them for myself. I actually want to designate, you know, my cousin to make these decisions for me. Please have those discussions with her and have it so that her name is in writing as your healthcare agent, because in that case, you will have had the discussion. Somebody knows your wishes, and that somebody can be contacted so that we have someone to talk to in the event that you become ill and are not able to communicate with us what your wishes are.
We had a listener who wanted us to make a point clear to a lot of people is to make sure that there is access to these documents, including the DNR, because we've all, I'm sure, heard of examples where some of these documents couldn't be located and families look at one another like, what did mom want?
Right, absolutely. That's why I typically use, for patients who have a prognosis roughly of under a year left of life, I use the PULSED form. I mentioned that before, Pennsylvania Order for Life-Sustaining Treatment. That form is a medical order signed by a physician or PA, CRNP, and it is a directive to EMS. It's out of hospital so that you can hang it literally on your fridge, the bright pink form. First question in the state of Pennsylvania is, do you want to have cardiopulmonary resuscitation if the person has no pulse and is not breathing? And that is a critical question, particularly for EMS in this day and age.
Marilyn asks, I'm not a fan of pain. How painful is it to be taken off a ventilator, assuming there is no hope for recovery? Dr. Olander?
That is a good question. So if you are in a situation where you are to be taken off a ventilator, there is an option to receive pre-medication with agents such as an opiate or a benzodiazepine, so colloquially things like morphine or Ativan. When that time comes for people, if that decision should be made, I strongly, strongly recommend the presence of hospice care to allow for recommendations to be made before somebody is extubated so that they can have a peaceful dying process with the aid of a hospice interdisciplinary team present. A hospice team can make recommendations to the inpatient staff about medicines that can be utilized to promote comfort and quality of life at the end of life. It is typically not, let's say, painful per se, but there could be issues with uncomfortable breathing or anxiety. And those elements are elements that a hospice team is very well trained to control and anticipate. And so that's why I implore patients, families, if their loved one is faced with the situation that they are to be extubated because they are not going to be anticipated to survive, I strongly recommend the presence of a hospice team prior to that extubation so that those recommendations can be made and that you have the support of a team there for the time that your loved one will pass.
Andrew, a question from a listener. How does one set up a trust fund for special needs adult child in one's will? Who would be the best trustee?
It's a great question. Setting it up within a will would take the form of having an extra article included within your will that deals with and directs the way in which the share for the disabled beneficiary would be held. So there are certain requirements that the trust language must have in there in order to not disqualify the beneficiary from typically means-based government assistance benefits. With respect to selecting a trustee, it's a great question. It's not an easy question to answer. It should be someone who is responsible, someone who is trustworthy, who is capable of understanding the disability of the beneficiary, but also the government benefit programs that the beneficiary is eligible for. And an incorrect distribution can disqualify a beneficiary from some of those programs. So if you have no one like that in your life, there are some great corporate bank and trust company options that are out there that do administer special needs trusts.
So we only have a few minutes left, and I just want to kind of provide an opportunity to summarize here. Maybe the basic question for you, Andrew Rusniak, is with drawing up a will, if you're doing it for the first time, you've mentioned about those who are updating it, taking a look at it every 3 to 5 years, but what are some of the things that people should think about when they're drawing up a will for the first time?
So typically that process involves kind of three core documents. When you think about it, when you say, I want to do estate planning, you're looking mainly at three core documents, and we've hit on all of them on our call here in one way or another. But the first two are fairly straightforward. It's your financial power of attorney, your healthcare power of attorney, and then the third document is your will. I always try to emphasize to folks to keep in mind that your powers of attorney are effective while you're alive, but while you're unable to make a decision for yourself. So whether it be financial related or health related, that's when those documents kick in. When a person dies, their powers of attorney die as well, and the will then becomes effective. So you want to be thinking about, for power of attorney selection purposes, at least with respect to finances, who would be a good person to name to be able to sign your checks and pay your bills, deal with your retirement accounts, that type of thing, if you're unable to do that for yourself. Healthcare, all the points that Dr. Oleander made are excellent points. When selecting that person to speak for you, you couldn't speak for yourself if you were in an end-stage medical condition. Your will, you want to be thinking about really just, who do I want to leave my estate to, and what do I want that to look like? If you're leaving it to young children or to someone who's maybe not responsible or just not appropriate to leave money to, you're typically looking at the use of trust provisions for that beneficiary. And so you'd want to be thinking about a trustee, and the trustee is the one that would manage the trust for that beneficiary. You want to be thinking about an executor. The job of the executor is to settle the estate, to gather things up, pay off the last taxes and debts and expenses, and then distribute your estate pursuant to the terms of your will. And then in coordination with all of those things, we want to make sure that we're aligning your beneficiary designations with what your will says. We said earlier that beneficiary designated assets don't pass through the will. They pass by contract designation. So you're looking at your life insurance designations, your retirement account beneficiary designations, and you're saying, does this align with what my will says? Because typically you don't want one asset going off one place and everything else going somewhere else, unless that's your intention. Most of the time, though, you want to make sure that your estate plan is coordinated and that everything ends up where you want it to go. So having a good sense and making sure that your estate planning attorney has a good sense of what your assets are so that he or she can help advise you is critical in that process.
I want to thank both of you for being with us today. Dr. Maria Olander, Associate Medical Director of Hospice of Central Pennsylvania, and Attorney Andrew Rusniak with the law firm McNeese Wallace and Nurek LLC. A lot of great information, and I'm sure there will be a lot of more people thinking about it after hearing this program and maybe during this time in particular. But thank you very much from both of you.
Thank you for having us, Scott.
And just wanted to pass along, Cindy from Palmyra, we had that question. We had that question about a disabled adult child. Cindy from Palmyra says, the best way to provide for your disabled heirs is the P-ABLE program. I'm not familiar with this, and I'm assuming I'm pronouncing it correctly, but it's P-A-ABLE. It says it's excellent and free. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. Welcome back to Smart Talk. America Amplified is a nationwide project that was designed to tell the stories of Americans in their communities during this presidential election year. But like many other plans in 2020, the COVID-19 pandemic has forced a change in direction at this time. WITF is part of the America Amplified initiative. Joining us is David Schleifer, Vice President, Director of Research with Public Agenda, a research and public engagement organization. Mr. Schleifer, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, first of all, let's start with, what is America Amplified?
Sure. So America Amplified is one of the media partners of Public Agenda's Hidden Common Ground initiative. Public Agenda is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization, and in this election year, we've been working with America Amplified, USA Today, and several other partners to survey Americans on some of the more divisive, more important issues that we're facing in this election year. And of course, because of the coronavirus, we've shifted our focus for at least the next few surveys to focus on that issue.
Before we get to the shift of the focus, one of the criticisms of journalists in 2016 is that there wasn't enough coverage of middle America. And I'm talking about literally, geographically, middle America, but then also figuratively, middle America, people living outside urban areas like New York and Los Angeles. Is this in response to that?
Well, I think that as a opinion research organization, we're always interested in how opinions may vary, how people may differ in their views and experiences by region or whether they live in big cities or not. And so that's sort of built into the type of work that we do. And part of what we were excited about in terms of partnering with America Amplified and with USA Today was their tremendous geographic reach outside of New York and Los Angeles and getting into communities across the country.
And we have an example of that. This is a report. Now, this is about 4 minutes long, but wanted to play this report for our listeners because it provides a good example of the project. Plus, it also provides some great information during the COVID-19. Let's give it a listen.
Americans finally found something they could agree on. When it comes to this current crisis, there's wide consensus we need to save lives and go slow in rebooting the economy. That's according to a new national survey with results released Friday. A majority of Americans show faith that their communities will recover from the pandemic, and some believe they will emerge stronger than ever. Christine Herman of Side Effects Public Media and America Amplified reached out to people who participated in the survey and has this report.
77-year-old Nova Powell lives in rural Texas in a tiny town called Pettibone.
It's an intersection with a curve in the road and about five houses altogether.
He's a Democrat and overall not thrilled with the federal government's handling of the pandemic. But he says he's been encouraged by small acts of kindness. Powell's wife, Deb, has asthma. She uses a breathing device that requires distilled water. When the local grocery store ran out, they went out of their way to find a few gallons just for him.
That's the kind of people that are here, and their politics are very far removed from mine.
The new survey conducted at the end of March by Public Agenda, USA Today, and Ipsos finds Powell is among the majority of people who feel their communities coming together during this time. Nearly half of all Americans say they've been reaching out to check on elderly and sick neighbors. And more than two-thirds say they're contacting family and friends more than usual and rallying to support local businesses. There is a partisan split over the handling of the crisis, with Republicans more than twice as likely as Democrats to feel the federal government is doing all it can. Still, David Schleifer, the director of research at Public Agenda, sees some surprising agreement.
You see a lot of support for the federal government taking a very active role in fighting the virus.
People on all sides of the political spectrum say the federal government's main priority should be preventing the spread of the virus by expanding testing, pressuring manufacturers to help, providing businesses with loans and aid, and passing legislation for paid sick leave. But roughly 20% of Americans, including 49-year-old Republican Jean Vo in Mobile, Alabama, think avoiding a recession should be top priority.
If this drags on for months, people lose their homes, families are split up, and it's going to be bad. So I really don't know that it's the right thing to do to completely shut down most of the economy to save lives.
With millions applying for unemployment in recent weeks, many who participated in the survey were already struggling, like Matthew Mullins in Grand Forks, North Dakota. The 25-year-old feels the government mandating paid sick leave would help protect everyone. Before he got laid off last month, he worked at a factory that processes potato products.
Very shortly before this all began, we had a coworker with the flu who wasn't willing to go home despite our protests.
46-year-old Rick Liskey in Toledo, Ohio, had also recently been laid off from his job as a sous chef.
If you lost a job any other time, there's so many restaurants around, you can go find one. Now, it's just not that way.
Liskey says as a gay man, the forced closure of restaurants and bars is a double whammy. Not only did he lose his job, he's lost his community.
You know, it's just not a bar. It's more of a community type deal, you know. It's kind of like being on Cheers where you want to go where everybody knows your name.
The one bright spot in all of this? Like many Americans, Liskey says he's checking in more often with his elderly parents. And he says he's hopeful this crisis will breed compassion that will help those who are struggling make it through. I'm Christine Herman, Side Effects Public Media.
This story was produced in partnership with America Amplified, a national public media collaboration focused on community engagement reporting.
David Schleifer, why is that a good example of what we're talking about, other than the fact that you're part of it?
Well, I think what's so great about Christine's reporting, as you just heard, is that it gets not just into what people think, but you really hear in her story the kind of struggle that people are going through really to make sense of what's happening. I mean, I think of the woman who was speaking about feeling like she's not sure whether it's a good idea to be shutting down the economy to save lives. And it's not out of cruelty on her part, but, you could really hear that struggle in her voice as she tried to make sense of what people ought to be doing and what we ought to be doing as a nation in this unprecedented time.
There does seem, you know, one of the takeaways that I got right off the bat, though, is that there does seem to be a sense of Americans coming together for a common cause, even if they do have some disagreements along partisan lines or along political lines, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we saw that, you know, about a quarter of Americans said that they have already donated in some way to help other people. Two-thirds say they're contacting friends and family more often. And many more say that they're likely to donate in the coming weeks.
So can you give us a bit of a preview as to what to expect in the coming weeks as far as surveys and hearing from Americans across the country?
Sure. So we do plan to continue to track some of the questions that we've already asked over the coming months and to ask some new questions. And I do think one thing that will be interesting to track is, first of all, how many people are actively seeking help? How many people are in financial
dire straits and how many people are seeking help. And I think it'll be interesting to find out as we get farther into this crisis how people rate the federal government's performance and also how people rate the performance and priorities of their state and local governments, which we know play a tremendous role in responding to this crisis.
I'm very interested to hear what people are saying in answers to those questions. David Schleifer, Vice President, Director of Research with Public Agenda, a research and public engagement organization. Mr. Schleifer, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, yes, we are continuing our coverage of a coronavirus pandemic. We've heard a lot about businesses and how they're coping, how they're surviving. And we'll hear from the National Federation of Independent Business and a couple banks tomorrow as well. That's on tomorrow's Smart Talk, so be sure to tune in.